Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The U.S. labels the International Criminal Court a national security threat. Strains in the U.S.-South Korea alliance. And a summit of authoritarian world leaders is held in Beijing. Labels the International Criminal Court a national security threat. The State Department said the U.S. will impose sanctions on two ICC judges and two prosecutors for, quote, transgressions against the U.S. and Israel. The ICC said the sanctions were a, quote, flagrant attack against the independence of an impartial judicial institution, unquote, that operates under the mandate of 125 countries. The State Department has targeted a judge from France for his role in issuing arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and his one-time defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and for Kimberly Prost of Canada, another judge, for her role in authorizing an investigation into U.S. military personnel at secret CIA sites in the years after the September 11 attacks in 2001. The sanctions freeze any assets the judges may have in the United States. These sanctions continue the Trump administration's assault on international law. In June, the State Department announced sanctions on four other International Criminal Court judges and the chief prosecutor for obtaining war crimes convictions of Netanyahu and Gallant. Neither the U.S. nor Israel is a party to the Rome Treaty that established the International Criminal Court. Arrest warrants are also being sought for three Hamas leaders. Strains in the U.S.-South Korea alliance. As President Lee Jae-myung prepared to meet with Donald Trump last week, Lee found that he would not only have to deal with high tariffs and China strategy, but also with Trump's unhappiness about the state of Korean politics. What is going on in South Korea? Trump wrote on social media. Seems like a purge or revolution. We can't have that and do business there. Was this another intervention in a friendly country's politics, as Trump attempted with Brazil? Or was it a phony attempt to strike a better trade deal? Trump probably was referring to an arrest warrant filed by Korean prosecutors for the former Prime Minister Han Duck-soo, whom they accused of trying to help the country's former president, Yoon Suk-yeol, to impose martial law after he was impeached. Yoon has been arrested twice in the last year on various charges related to his ill-fated bid to stay in power. Lee's talk with Trump turned out to be reasonably successful, in that Lee got Trump to reduce the U.S. tariff rate on Korean goods to 15%, though it had been zero before Trump's tariff war. Nevertheless, Korean banks believe the economy, heavily dependent on exports to the U.S., will inevitably take a hit. But Korea's proposal for joint shipbuilding struck a positive chord with Trump. For South Korea, the trade framework previously established is just one source of upset over U.S. policies. Another is China. Will U.S. forces stationed in Korea be used to contain China, as opposed to deterring North Korea? Is South Korea expected to participate in defense of Taiwan if China attacks Taiwan? A third issue is defense payments to the U.S. Trump wants a major increase to $10 billion. In short, U.S.-Korea relations have only temporarily been smoothed over with President Lee's trip. Of authoritarian world leaders is held in Beijing. The leaders of China, Russia, and India, all with grudges to bear against the United States, came together in Beijing under the auspices of the 26-member Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. Most important was the appearance of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whose dispute with Donald Trump over tariffs and the Nobel Peace Prize has upended the once close relationship between the U.S. and India. Now it looks like India has joined in a Sino-Russian project to create an alternative world order. Xi Jinping says he wants partnership, not rivalry, with India. Modi agreed, but insisted that India be viewed as an independent actor, not a U.S. ally. Nevertheless, it will be hard for China and India to paper over their long-running border dispute, India's rejection of China's Belt and Road Initiative, and Chinese resentment of India's refusal to endorse SCO joint statements. Xi Jinping had the key role at the summit, urging unity against decoupling and power politics and support for multipolar politics, all signature Chinese themes addressed to U.S. hegemony. Xi and Modi had a private one-on-one conversation during the meeting. China has proposed that the SCO, like the BRICS, establish its own development bank. Xi announced billions of dollars in grants, loans, and scholarships to the SCO states. Russia's economy is weakening. Forbes magazine reports that, quote, Russia could slip into a recession soon and is having its worst harvest in 17 years, further straining an economy that's already seen energy revenue plunge, unquote. That is the view of Tatiana Orlova, lead economist for emerging markets at Oxford Economics. The fact that the Alaska summit between Putin and Trump did not produce any agreement to promote U.S.-Russia economic cooperation informs her forecast, which also sees Russian GDP growth slowing sharply this year to just 1.2% from 4.3% in 2024. Russia's economy minister has also forecast a recession, and Russian banks worry about a debt crisis. The central budget is showing the strains of 3.5 years of war. Anders Aslund, a prominent European Russia specialist, says that, quote, Russia's economy is fast approaching a fiscal crunch that will encumber its war effort. Though that may not be enough to compel Putin to seek peace, it does suggest that the walls are closing in on him. Democratic staff report cites Trump's easing of sanctions on Russia. A minority staff report for two Senate committees argues that the Trump administration halted new sanctions and export controls on Russia for 6 months, leading to a significant drop in pressure on Russia. The report found that when Trump took office, the administration, quote, immediately stopped taking basic sanctions and export control actions that had maintained and increased U.S. pressure, unquote. Further, says the report, the administration has further undermined Ukraine's leverage by repeatedly signaling a lack of commitment to maintaining effective sanctions, unquote. For example, the report cites the administration's weakening of the G7 group's position on Russia sanctions, its disbanding of a key initiative against Russian oligarchs, its undermining of Europe's sanctions on a Russian bank, its rejection of a G7 proposal to help crack down on opaque Russian oil exports, and its public statements that sanctions on Russia are too costly to implement. Japan-U.S. trade talks hit a snag. Japan's top trade negotiator canceled his trip to the U.S. at the last minute. Quote, it was found that there are points that need to be discussed at the administrative level during coordination with the American side. Therefore, the trip has been canceled, said a Japanese government spokesperson. The snag evidently has to do with the investment promise that the Japanese had made, a promise which, as I discussed last week, led Trump to boast that it would put $550 billion in the U.S. government's pocket. That's not what the Japanese intended. Trump's tariffs are ruled illegal. A federal appeals court on August 29th determined that Trump did not have the authority to impose tariffs worldwide, striking down Trump's use, or abuse really, of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. That act does not authorize tariffs or the trade deficit as actions that fall within a national emergency. However, the court allowed the tariffs to remain in place on the assumption the Supreme Court will take them up. Trump's response, quote, if these tariffs ever went away, it would be a total disaster for the country, unquote. That's strange. Before the tariffs were imposed, the country was doing just fine. Next, three items on the war in Israel. First, journalists are a target. As of August 25th, 244 journalists have been killed in the war. The latest casualties were four journalists from four different news agencies. They were killed in an horrific Israeli Defense Forces attack on a Gaza hospital. There is little doubt that journalists are not simply collateral damage. They are being targeted. U.S. news agencies have been nearly silent about the attacks, even as their own affiliated journalists die. The second item concerns Israeli public opinion, which remains highly divided and contradictory on the war. A report by the International Institute for Strategic Studies finds that despite strong public support for the Netanyahu government's strikes on Iran, 82% of Jewish Israelis supported the strikes against Iran, and 61% favored expanding the war's goals to include regime change, nevertheless, opinion continues to be contradictory. More than two-thirds of the Israeli public favored a war-ending hostage deal in July, including 86% of opposition voters, but nearly as many also wanted to see Hamas completely destroyed. The political upshot is that the Knesset, Israel's parliament, is deadlocked. Netanyahu isn't strong enough to call for an election to stay in office, and the opposition doesn't have enough votes to oust him. And the third item, Trump's Gaza development scheme is revealed. The Washington Post published a leaked prospectus for the plan, which would involve the forced displacement of Gaza's entire population of 2 million people and put the territory into a U.S. trusteeship for at least a decade. The plan would be the realization of Donald Trump's and Jared Kushner's dream to transform Gaza into a high-tech Riviera with megacities powered by AI. Palestinian residents would be given a choice, either voluntarily relocate outside the country or be given a Bitcoin to move to micro-homes and receive a pittance for their property. A human rights executive based in Switzerland called the plan, quote, a textbook case of international crimes on an unimaginable scale, forcible population transfer, demographic engineering, and collective punishment, unquote. He and others warned that companies that invest in the plan would be subject to lawsuits for abetting ethnic cleansing. No official in Washington or Tel Aviv could be reached for comment. Next, two very different stories on the environmental front. First, some good news, major gains in global hygiene. From Fix the News on Substack, billions of people have gained clean water, sanitation, and hygiene in the last 9 years. New data from the World Health Organization and UNICEF show that between 2015 and 2024, humanity recorded one of the fastest expansions of basic welfare of all time. 961 million people gained safe drinking water, 1.2 billion gained safe sanitation, and 1.5 billion gained access to basic hygiene services, while the number of unserved fell by nearly 900 million. Coverage has risen to 74%, 58%, and 80% respectively, while open defecation has dropped by 429 million people. Together, these figures represent an historic advance in human health and dignity. On the other hand, in Pakistan, switching to solar power has cost the poor. Solar power has become the top source of electricity in Pakistan, as imports of solar panels from China have taken off. One would think this is great news for all Pakistanis, as solar has been adopted everywhere, even in mosques, and savings on electricity have been huge. But not for everyone. Only the rich have gone off the power grid, leaving the poor, who cannot afford the solar panels, to rely on coal-powered energy. And as wealthier people leave the grid, the electricity becomes more expensive for those who still rely on it. It's a death spiral, says one solar executive. Pakistan is thus in an awful energy quandary. It overinvested in coal power and now has too many plants and high debts. On the other hand, too many people are going off the grid and onto solar, leaving the country energy divided. Finally, two updates. First, from Thailand, where the Constitutional Court dismissed Prime Minister Pettongtong Shinawatra, the youngest prime minister in the country's history, for an ethics violation. She became the sixth premier from or backed by the billionaire Shinawatra family to be removed by the military or judiciary in a tumultuous two-decade battle for power between the country's warring elites. Thai politics is now in upheaval as those elites contend for control of the prime ministership. And second, in India, the export economy is reeling as Trump's 50% tariffs begin. Business and workers in textiles, jewelry, carpets, and shrimp are all suffering due to their dependence on the U.S. market. Exporter associations estimate that the tariffs could affect nearly 55% of India's $87 billion worth of merchandise exports to the U.S. and benefit competitors such as Vietnam, Bangladesh, and China, which have been tariffed at lower rates. Some business leaders in India are hoping Trump will change his mind, but after five rounds of trade talks, he hasn't budged, and neither has Prime Minister Modi from his determination to keep buying Russian oil. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.